I have lost some pretty big deals in my career with some pretty notable logos. And when I look back to deals I've lost with, companies like Zendesk, let's say, HubSpot, I was working a deal with Gartner, this is about a year or so ago. What it always came back to was, one, I didn't have enough people involved in the deal, and I didn't have the right people involved in the deal. And what we're going to be talking about today is what I call the subtle art of multi-threading complex deals. We're going to be talking to Jen Allen, who's in charge of community growth at Lavender and also worked at Challenger for 18 years. Before we get to that, though, thanks for checking out the podcast. Welcome to Outbound Squad. My name's Jason Bay. You can call me J Bay. Our goal at Outbound Squad is to help turn complete strangers into paying customers. So if you're a sales rep, maybe a BDR or an SDR doing a lot of prospecting, or you're an account executive that's doing some prospecting, doing some closing, all that kind of stuff, you're definitely in the right place. We talk both about outbound and selling. And today, what I'm super excited to dig into with Jen, who I'm a big fan of, I'm a big fan of Challenger as well. And she just moved on from Challenger and is working at Lavender. So we talk about her journey being at Challenger for 18 years. We talk about sort of her, what she called the old way of selling. So for her, it was, I got to get consensus from all these people to sell the deal. And the way she looks at it now, and through the latter half of her career, is how do I get early consensus on the problem? Because if everyone agrees on the problem that we have, they're much more aligned that way. We talk next about how to know if you're speaking with the right person. When I think a lot of the deals that I lost, it wasn't that I wasn't talking to the right person necessarily. It was I was talking to a person that wasn't able to get a lot of access to executives in the company so that we could have more stakeholders in the room. They weren't in Challenger speak, a mobilizer. And then the third thing that we dig into, I think you're going to get a lot of value from, is really just her process for multi-threading complex deals. A little nugget she shared was that she looks for skeptical prospects. She proactively seeks out the skeptical stakeholder, how to get problem consensus, all that kind of stuff. So if you're an account executive and you're working, large mid-market or enterprise or strat deals, you're going to get a ton of value from this. So without further ado, let's get to the interview with Jen. So one of the stuff that, well, two things happened, I guess, before we hit record this time. This is take two. the other thing that we started digging into was this concept of multi-threading. And the reason why I wanted to talk to you about this is because you have so much experience, I imagine, probably doing it the wrong way a lot, much like I have and a lot of people end up doing. And you just have a lot of experience working large, complex deals. And I wanted to first, I think a couple of stats would be kind of interesting maybe to start with. But you guys used to share a really big one at Challenger. The 38% of deals are lost to status quo. Can you, like, when you look at that, when you see that data, when you kind of look under the hood, what didn't happen in those buying cycles that needed to take place?
Yeah. So first of all, I love how much you love to geek out on sales data. This is why we like and bond. So for me, if I reflect on the mistakes I made in my career and I look at that 38% data, there's a very clear story of what I was missing, which is I would attach myself to a single stakeholder who got excited about the product I was selling. I would let them tell me all about why they wanted to buy it. I would assume that their singular point of view represented the entire organization's point of view. And where those deals would almost always die is the moment that it went from that one person getting excited about the solution to them getting everybody else in the business on board. And what I realized is I was actually harming the outcome that I was leading us to no decision because I would spend my time with that person. Maybe I did great discovery, maybe I understood the problem. And then I switched to solution. And then I would take that individual and I would say, here, now go shop this solution around the business and tell everybody how great it is. What I failed to appreciate is nobody else in the business was part of that problem conversation. So they may be prioritizing a completely different set of problems or priorities. And so when they came, when that stakeholder I was working with came to them and was like, we should buy this because of this, they were completely misaligned on why that problem should be prioritized. And I would say it's exacerbated in the last year because we don't have cash flowing like it used to. So we have to be picky about problems we solve.
Yeah, there's so much there that you shared that I don't want to gloss over. And there's like this, I don't know, the buying process, so many, like Gartner outlines it a particular way, HubSpot's got a, you know, kind of thing, but there's kind of this like consideration phase that I think everyone kind of has a consensus around where, like what you said there, the individual has to feel it's important, right? That the other people have to feel it's important. And then it has to kind of go through this other layer of, is this even a priority? Because there's a lot of other shit that we could be, you know, working on as well. When you think about getting other people involved, where I fear that people go when they kind of hear that is like, oh, so I'm just gonna like basically the status quo of multi-threading is at the end of a call, hey Jen, so who do you think who else do you think might really care about the who else might
part of the buying process? Nobody, nobody.
So there's so much nuance to this topic. And I think just from kind of a principle standpoint, if you had to step back and look at, so I need to get other people involved there. I think people are on the same page that, hey, the more people I get involved, like there's a lot of data supporting that the win rates grow up and all that kind of stuff. I think this is really more of a how-to thing that is a challenge for most folks. How do you think about, just from a principal standpoint, getting other people involved, like the mechanics of doing that, when you bring it up, how do you know who should be involved? How do you go about actually, you know, making that happen? How do you kind of think about that part?
Yeah, this is my favorite thing, because I think this is the thing about selling that has shifted so dramatically in the last, let's say, 5 years, as consensus continues to rise as a way that companies make buying decisions. So what I will compare what I used to do to how I think now. I used to think the farther along those conversations went, the more I had to push to the outcome of selling it, right? So it's like, I don't want to back up once I'm here because I'm close to the finish line. So I got to keep pushing. And how do I just get this deal done quickly? That resulted in a lot of loss to status quo deals for me. Now, my philosophy is, if I get an individual on board with the problem we're solving and how we're solving it, at that point, now I need to decide, is this person someone that has the credibility, the willingness, and the ability to actually go and steward a conversation with the broader team? I don't need them to have the entire conversation, but I need them to be able to bring it up. So that's job number one, is, am I actually attached to the right person who, if they go to other people in the business, they're not going to roll their eyes? And that might sound obvious, but there were plenty of times where I put my deal in the hands of someone who just said all the right things, and then I realized they have no credibility back. So that's job number one. Job number two is, now if I do in fact have the right person, now I need to back them up, right? I actually probably need to slow them down. So they're hyped up. They want to buy the solution, right? They see how it fits the problem. They want to go tell everybody, let's get on board with this. My job as a seller, I think, is to back them up and say, you see the problem clearly. You see the solution problem clearly. I guarantee Joe over here in customer success probably doesn't prioritize this the same way. So what I need you to do is not pitch the solution. What I need you to do is get a forum together where we can have a honest, open conversation and disagree about whether this is even the right problem to solve. And so that's where I think the job of a seller shifts dramatically, because when I get the buying group together, most of us are taught, hey, that's where you sell the solution because it's limited access. Once you get in front of them, you got to sell it. I think that's completely backwards. When you get the buying group together, our role shifts from someone who's trying to convince someone to do something to someone who's saying, look, I'm a third-party facilitator. I'm going to ask questions to get you guys to disagree openly so that we can have an honest conversation about whether this is even the right thing to the right problem to prioritize. And we're not going to talk about the solution at all until we decide, do we have consensus on the problem itself, how much it's costing us, and should we even do something about it? So I think, long way of saying, like, it takes a lot of restraint for sellers, for we sellers to do that, because we feel like we're close to the finish line. But that's where these deals, I think, blossom, because that entire buying group is either on board with the problem or they're not. And so I don't have to waste my time trying to pitch or demo a solution if I know that the customer's like, yo, this isn't even the right problem to be solving.
Okay. Yeah, we could spend an hour on, like, individually each of those three areas. Okay, I want to make sure I'm on the same page with you. So you said the old way was you would push hard for consensus, like, later in the sales cycle, and it was really just to win the deal. It was all about, like, okay, now it's time. We know that we need to get so-and-so to sign this, and so-and-so needs to authorize this. It's going to come out of so-and-so's budget or whatever. Like, let's get these people involved so that they can, like, agree on the solution and then sell it. And what I'm hearing you say now, correct me if I'm wrong, is that earlier in the sales process, you're looking to build consensus much earlier and to do it around the problem first.
Yeah.
Then once we have that, yeah, okay.
No, that's exactly, like, I'll give you a perfect example. I would get a lot of people coming in saying, hey, I read the Challenger sale. I really want to buy training. I'm like, great, sweet. How many sellers and who needs to say yes? And then I get all the stakeholders on the phone and I'd be like, this is why Challenger is a better sales training program than what you're doing today. And half of them would be like, I don't even think we should be doing sales training. I think we should buy a piece of tech, right? And so I was neglecting that because I was pushing my solution versus if I now go in, at my job when I was there, I would go in and say, let's talk about this problem of no decision. Like, do we actually understand how many deals we lose to customers just saying good is good enough? And as a result, what happens is you have an opportunity to teach and learn with the buying group. And by the end of that conversation, you either get people saying, shoot, we are losing way more to no decision than I realized, or no, we're fine. And this other thing takes priority. But I'm always mindful of, like, my time is just as important as a buyer's. And so I don't want to convince people to buy a solution for a problem they don't prioritize. But I was just skipping that step previously.
Yeah. And it's I think about how most onboarding occurs for account executives and like the advice that they're given and the support in this area. It's very solution oriented. So this is like this whole approach is I don't want to say, when I say backwards, it almost sounds like in a bad way, but it is very much a flip-flop of what you would normally do. So we're going to push for consensus early, and we're going to push for consensus around the problem. So this, are we talking to the right person or not? I think a scenario that this is what I find myself in a lot, and many of the reps that I work with across sales teams, big and small, the conversation, the first one is usually with someone that doesn't have a lot of internal influence usually. So, and this is nothing against sales enablement or sales managers. Like, those people are great coaches, like in the sales process. But can you, I guess, maybe talk first about the difference between, in medic, they kind of call it coach and champion. I don't know what kind of verbiage you use, but someone that can help you a lot, that's more of a talker, I guess, in challenger speak versus a mobilizer. If we kind of start there, like the different types, and then what are some of the ways that you might go about figuring out what kind of, like, if you are talking to the right person that can help you or not?
Yeah. And this is a place where I will totally give credit to Challenger because it completely changed how I looked at stakeholders. So for those of you that haven't read the Challenger customer, they basically did an analysis of buyer behaviors, and they identify that there's these different profile types of people you run up against. And it has nothing to do with role or seniority or tenure or any of that stuff. It has everything to do with how they react to the way that you teach about the problem. So I found myself, prior to learning this, gravitating towards people who would get really excited about my solution. And they'd tell me every dirty detail about, well, here's what you need to know about John, and here's what we did before. Because I'm like, man, this is someone who's so invested. Clearly, they're going to be a passionate advocate for this. Except more often than not, when it came time for that moment where I was like, all right, now I need you to go to the rest of the group, all of a sudden they disappeared. Challenger kind of bucketed those folks into talkers. Talkers, it's like nice people talking to nice people, getting nothing done. Mobilizers are people that often will present as skeptical, right? The third type is blockers. We'll talk about them in a second. Like, mobilizers may listen to your insight or your view of the problem, and they'll sit there and they'll ask you really hard questions. And average performers will sit there and say, oh, this person's not interested. I've got to back off. High performers will look at that and they'll say, this is someone who is putting me through the vetting system, because they don't let everybody that's a vendor through the door. So I know if I can pass this test that they're giving me right now, it's not like they invite every vendor off the street into the buying group. So I'm probably talking to someone who puts every vendor through this process. And when they speak up with the rest of the buying group looks at them and says, like, John never invites people in. So let's take this a little bit more seriously. So I'm actually looking intentionally for skepticism, because skepticism shows you're thinking. Skepticism shows this is contradicting a conventional way we've always done it. All of the good stuff. And then your third camp are blockers, right? Your blockers are people who are just pro status quo. It has nothing to do with you in some cases. Sometimes it does, but they just want to protect same. So where I ran up against this a lot, and you've probably seen this too, is like, I'm trying to sell a sales training program to a sales enablement person who literally just built a sales training program for their company. I don't care how good what I'm selling is. They're like, I am trying to protect what I just built. It took me 2 years to build it. So that's a blocker.
Gotcha. So excitement does not equal influence is kind of a big part of that. I've definitely learned that the hard way, for sure. People, when you put out content, come in. I can't imagine what it was like for you. It's like what I go through times 10, because there's like this big book and movement around it where people come in and they're super jacked, and it's like there isn't even like a project internally at all. You know, they're just excited and like want a fanboy or fangirl sometimes, you know, which is tough. So what are some of the, can you give an example of maybe some of the questions that you might ask someone to determine how much influence that they have?
Yeah. And I want to be careful with the word influence, because I think influence connotates this idea of like seniority. And I will say, and I'm curious for your experience here too, some of the deals that I've closed in the past few years, I would have never made that person my entry point, like just based on title, based on experience, right? But there's a few things I'm looking for. There's a few things I'm asking for. One is I'm looking for people that have evidence of comfort with change. So to be very specific, if I looked at when I did my analysis of deals I won and lost every single year, one of the most common factors of deals I won were there was someone in the business that had changed at a leadership rank, like new CEO. Sometimes it was the person buying, but sometimes it was those around it. So like change is already happening in the business. So as a result, one of the questions I'll ask, or one of the things candidly I'll do before I even get to the call, is say, is this the same leadership team for the last 20 years? Like, what's the likelihood these dudes and ladies are going to change? Probably limited. Or is there a new force, a new thing that has come in that has actually disrupted something? Because where disruption exists, change is obviously a little bit easier to swallow. So if I can observe that in my prep, I'll do that in my prep. If I can't, I'll ask in the call. Two is I'm looking for someone who can almost, I hate saying it this way, but almost sell me on the problem. So I'm a big fan of not going in and trying to convince anybody to do anything. I'm a big fan of putting out an observation that I have about their business and saying, it looks to me like, let's just use a real example, right? If I was selling to a gifting company, I might go in and say, look, it looks to me like gifting was really popular a year ago, right? Because it was new and it was shiny object and everybody had money to spend. But now I wonder, how hard is it for sellers to get customers to step back and say, actually, gifting has a role beyond just trying to get a cold call. Like there's roles that it can play otherwise. Like how hard is that for your sellers? And then I just shut up and listen, right? And I want to hear, does the person unaided think about the problem I'm trying to solve, which would be status quo, in a similar way? And if we talk similarly, if they look at it similarly, it's not that they have to get everything right, but if they talk about the problem the same way, that's jacking up my confidence, because that's exactly what they're going to go and do with the rest of the buying group, is talk about the problem. So I want to hear, how does this person talk about, are they running to solution, or can they sit in problem land and really tell great stories, give great examples, cite data? That to me is like one of the best signs of a great mobilizer, because I need them to go do that back inside the business.
Wow. So sell me on the problem. That's a really interesting the language that they use, how they do it, you're kind of just picking up on a lot of like their ability to have the conversation like with the rest of the people that you talked about. That's super interesting. So you proactively look for skepticism, people comfortable with change. You're looking at leadership changes, like what might be going on from a research standpoint that you can pick up. Is there anything else, like when you go into a first meeting with a net new account, net new opportunity, is there anything else that you're looking for in your research to help you kind of think about who else might be a person that would be involved with this or additional stakeholders, that sort of stuff? What else are you looking for?
Love your questions. So I'm looking for, based on what I've seen in other deals, who else might I hypothesize would get involved? And then, so I'm doing that in my prep. So I'm saying, all right, like my entry points, sales enablement, the same, I have the same attitude as you about that. I'm going to say, like, you're not going to switch the way you sell without the VPs of sales buying into it. You're probably not going to switch the way you sell without like HR and marketing involved in it. So I'm going to try to do as much of that in my prep to identify who I think might be the right person, recognizing like I'll probably get some of it wrong. And then I'm going to bring that and I'm going to say, look, you know, it seems like you're pretty impassioned about the problem. Best guess from an outsider's perspective is these people are going to have a say in it. Who out of this group do you think is going to be most skeptical of change and why? And then again, I want to shut up and listen and hear how effective are these people at being, at looking at the problem through someone else's eyes. Like if I'm hearing someone say, oh yeah, they'll be on board because they want to grow. I'm like, that's a terrible reason. Like I want actually someone who's going to say, I think John's going to resist on this because he's really big into training provider X. And that's going to be a hard sell because that shows me like, you know, this buying group, you know, these intricacies, you know, the politics. That again, that's someone who I want to lean in with because they're going to do a really good job reading the room.
Okay. This is going to sound like a really prescriptive question, but I understand it's not prescriptive, very prescriptive. So when you're doing a first call, I'm going to guess you probably would book 30 to 45 minutes, like for a very first call with a new stakeholder, let's say. At what point are you going to shift the conversation into kind of, for lack of a better way of saying it, validating your stakeholder hypothesis? Like, when does the conversation shift into that? What are the things that need to happen before the conversation goes? And I'm really curious how you bring up the conversation too, because that's where a lot of people get stuck and shut down, where you get the classic, I'm the decision maker. We don't need to involve other people, you know, like that kind of shit.
This is why, like, I don't know your philosophy on BANT, but I'm in the BANT camp because I'm like, nobody's.
Yeah.
I don't have.
Oh, definitely.
I have no decision making. Like, I don't know who those people are. So this is a great question. And this took me a really long time to get right. Time management was something I struggled with for a really long time. Like for a very long time, my first call sucked. What I realize is that when you get really tight about how you manage your first call, you can get a lot more done in 30 minutes than we often give ourselves credit for. So to be very specific, when I go into that first call, because I've done this homework, because I've built a point of view or a hypothesis that may be wrong, but I position it as like, it's just that, like I'm an outsider, tell me what I've missed. We can very quickly get into problem assessment right off the bat. And in that conversation of problem assessment, I'm not trying to convince them they have the problem. I'm trying to, as we talked about, I'm trying to gauge to what extent are they impassioned about the problem. And then I'm switching to, there's a way to size this problem. I don't need to size it with you right now, but I need you to understand there's a way to calculate how big this problem is. So for me, it was always about help them realize how much time their sellers are spending on deals that end in status quo. And I'm positioning them for the next call to say, I want you to go get this data point and this data point so we can actually, before you shop this around and look like an idiot, make sure the problem is actually really big, right? And then that logically leads me into a conversation of, we're going to dig into this more in the next call, but out of curiosity, it looks like this person, this person, this person would probably have an opinion on whether we even do anything at all about this problem. Who am I missing? And who out of that group do you think is most skeptical around this problem? So again, I'm doing everything related to the problem, not who's most skeptical about this training program. It's all about the problem. And then that's teeing me up to either know, hey, this person gets it. They know who the people are, or they don't. And if they don't, boy, is that a trigger to what you talked about before, to say, I'm not going to put all my eggs in this basket. So I'll still do the next call with them and say, let's work together to size the problem. But that in my next call, then I'm going to be thinking about how do I actually open this up so that they understand I need to quickly move into buying group and not stay with them. So that really is like, if I think about the architecture of a call, I'm really trying to repeat that as much as possible in every single call so I can just get better at that motion. And it leads into a really logical reason for the next call instead of just like, let's just talk again to talk about, I don't know, whatever next steps.
Yeah. I have, in my personal experience doing this too, noticed that if you focus a lot on the problem and not in my case, training and coaching and playbook creation, if you focus less on that, people are just less resistant about involving other people.
Yes.
You know, like the sale I'm being sold alarm doesn't go off where it's like, okay, you're just involving these people so that you can waste their time and try to pitch them and like, you know, make it a complete waste of my boss's time or whoever, you know? So let's in this scenario, assume that let's say that this, cause I feel like this is the most common situation. Let me know if you've seen differently in your experience where that person might be able to provide some really good insight, but they're not really a mobilizer, if we're going to use that language, where maybe it's a couple people on the sales enablement team, great people, but their sales enablement managers, they've just been tasked because there's an open project to look for trainers. They've been tasked to like kind of look for people. And you know that I need to get some more senior people involved. How do you have that conversation? What does that, what are the kind of bullet points of that in that first call?
Yeah. So there's a couple ways I go about it. So this, I would totally understand if you disagree with this, because I'm not even certain that it's the best way to go about it. If they've been tasked with the job, that's different to me, mm-hmm. right? Because someone said, go do it. They might suck at it, but someone said, go do it. So in that motion, even yeah. if I don't think they're the best mobilizer, what I'm going to do is just take all of that effort off their plate. And I talk about this a lot. I'm going to write the email for them so that they don't say, hey, I want you all to come in a meeting so we can talk about this training program. I'm going to write it such that it's poised on the problem and it eliminates human error from the equation. And then I'm just going to say, like, I need you to send this and here's why I've structured it this way and don't do it this way because here's what I've seen in my experience and where that falls apart and where you look bad, right? So if someone is tasked with it, I'm going to do that because it could – I've lost deals actually for going above their head and just being like, I'll go to the right person. So that's how I approach it if they're tasked with it. If they are not tasked with it, I kind of believe because I'm not at the point yet talking about us or our solution, I've personally not seen a lot of risk in just stepping back and saying, look, like what you've shared with me today is invaluable. But as I reflect on what it's going to take for you to have to go around and get consensus on this, I don't know if that's the best path forward, recognizing you also told me you have this, this, and this that you're doing. Are you open to me having some further conversations? I'll lead it. You can point me in the right direction so that I can continue to get smart about the different perspectives on this problem so you don't walk into something, you know, ending up getting a bunch of skepticism from the people around you. So I'm trying to frame it in a way of like, I don't want to be inauthentic about it, but like nobody wants to be that person who's forcing people to come to a meeting who they're pissed off that they're in that meeting. And so I'm trying to create like that is what you're going to do if you continue to want to own this when you haven't been asked to. So I don't know if that is the best way. It's the way that I do it.
No, I like it. Hey, you're more of a master at this than I am. Okay. So I'm like, I'm here to learn from you. Okay. I feel like that's really the only, if you don't do that, what you run the risk of is that person bringing it to other people and then it getting shot down really early. And like Ian Koniak, I don't know how well you know Ian. Yeah. He says something I love. He said, don't take a no from someone that can't give you a yes.
Oh, I love I'm like, that.
Oh God, that's so good. You know? So you get a no from someone that cannot give you the yes. They're not a part of the committee of people that can give you the yes. And then now after that, if you go try to approach, let's say you close lost that deal and then reopen it to approach the buying committee, you're kind of like starting from behind the starting line at that point because you've already been shot down by someone that they tasked to go look for potential solutions. So I want to be really clear just for the people listening. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. The posture, and this is sort of what I teach, is don't ask for permission With multi-threading, it's more like coaching and telling the person what needs to happen in order for them to get what they want.
I think that is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And this is what we get. Like, this is the benefit of living in problem land. Because if you're not giving someone to shop, something to shop around, you're not taking anything away from them. So if you jump into solution, it's like, oh, I'm going to be the steward of the solution. But if you're just having a conversation about the problem, you actually don't really need permission at all, do you? Like, hey, I want to continue to get different perspectives about this problem.
Yeah, because it doesn't really feel like selling at that point, you know? And this would be a conversation for another podcast episode, but there's an assumption here too that when someone comes in looking for training, let's say, or a solution, that you have the ability in that call to reframe the conversation around the problem that that's going to solve. And I think that's really easy to do too. I've done it a lot where someone's really excited because they've been consuming the content. They want to look into the training. They want to get pricing. They want to do all of this stuff. And we haven't even established if there's a problem, who cares about it, if it's worth fixing. And those end up in status quo a lot too, you know, where it isn't positioned correctly. So, okay. So if we kind of continue down this road, a couple other things I want to just zoom in on. So if you have that person, you're basically telling them that I'm going to help you do a lot of this work. You're literally writing the email for them to send. Do you ever tell them, like, do you ever through email loop in the other stakeholders? Where, like, something that I've been doing, for example, is we talk to the sales enablement team. They get excited about it and they're bought into like helping. And they're like, okay, cool. Well, the VP of sales development, they're going to have a lot of input on this SKO and the workshops. And then they're going to be setting meetings for these AEs who are led by this person. And then I'll just say, cool, I'm going to send them an email. I'm going to mention our conversation. I'm not going to have an ask in it, but I want to loop them in early in case they want to join. Are you doing stuff like that too? Do you suggest that? And this is kind of territory also where I feel like you can get in trouble if, like, I'm a really firm believer in not going around the person without, like, you need to tell the person what you're going to, the people involved, what you're going to do, especially if it's going to have their name in it. But what are your thoughts on that? Do you do any kind of like, hey, let's thread some people in through email a little earlier, just give them the heads up that this is going on as we're having conversations so that when it comes time, that second, third meeting or whenever it is to invite these people, there's already an email thread of you saying, hey, here's what I understand the problem to be. Here's some cool content that you can check out around this. And like that third or fourth email in that chain has got like a value chain in it of like problem and like all this other kind of stuff. Or do you suggest doing any of that kind of thing? Are you doing that kind of stuff in this process at all? Or
I mean, God, I could talk to you for like a 24 hours straight. So I like that. I'll be honest, I don't do it, not because I don't think you should, but because I haven't thought of it like that. So I think that's a killer way to do it. The way that as you were talking, I'm reflecting on, like, I think I try to get to the same outcome, but maybe in a different path. And this is where I'm very bullish on anybody who has an SDR that works with them. I think we're missing a big opportunity on how we can be using or working with them, not using them. That's terrible language. So in my mind, if I like have one of these first calls and we understand the problem state, right? What I now want to do is take content, things that are innately designed to be helpful, not sell our solution, and now use my knowledge of what they've told me the problem is and start sharing that out with end users. So as an example, right, you know, I did the Challenger podcast for a really long time. We talked about all sorts of problems. We did not sell Challenger on that. It was just designed to try to help sellers with these problems. So let's say I get off a call with someone who's losing to status quo. I ask them where it's breaking down and they're like, it's the first meeting. My tendency was, I didn't have an SDR, but I would have done this. But I think if you have an SDR, this is a great place for them to send their time, is figure out who would be ultimately affected by this solution. Like, who are those end users? Now push out problem-centric content to them so we can build an affinity towards Challenger. Because at some point, to your point, they're going to be tapped and say, what do you think about this, right? And I want them to be like, oh, I just saw something. It's not a guarantee that they'll watch it, right? We all know that.
Yeah.
But if we can then prime them in a way that doesn't feel like we're doing it so that we can help them buy our thing, but we're actually just like out there helping them. It kind of sounded kind of, like, sounds kind of sneaky now that I say it like that, but it is a little sneaky, right? Like I want their affinity towards the way that we look at the problem and what we're doing to help them. So I think I kind of backdoor it instead of loop them in. But again, it's not because I don't think we should do that. I just think I hadn't considered it that way.
This is such a pro move. I was just thinking about this. I was like, if we talk to a director or VP of sales about something, and that's where the conversation gets started kind of early. And if it's at a really large company, maybe a lot of the reps I'm not connected with on LinkedIn, why not use that opportunity to run a play and in, you know, either engage directly with reps or engage directly with the sales managers and say, hey, just letting you know, we've been talking to some of your leadership about this problem. Not sure if you're running into it. I have like a little one pager with like all of our best outbound content on it. Do you want me to share it with you? Yeah. You know, and then now it's like, yeah, imagine organically if stuff is happening where the VP is like, sends a message out to the managers is like, hey, what do you guys think? Do we need training right now? Like I've been looking into this dude over here at Outbound Squad. And then they're like, oh yeah, our reps already consume their content. Like that's a huge plus. And I think that, again, I don't want to gloss over this too, is that consensus, I don't know, I've made the mistake of like, oh God, I got to go senior. And I think sometimes something that's really easy to forget is the people that are going to be using the product or engaging in this case with the training. Because that's a lot of what a senior stakeholder, like what they will rely on too is, you know, implementation. I think that they talk about this in the Challenger books around framing the multi-threading conversation around a successful implementation. You know, it's like, think past the sale, like implementations oftentimes don't go well because a product or service is sold to a company and there wasn't consensus before it was sold with the people that would be implementing it, you know? Yes. And I think that's a really great way to frame the conversation too, you know?
It is. Think about like any, I have so much empathy for anybody who decides, I mean, you and I live in the same world, like anybody who decides to switch up their sales training program, you have a big freaking bullseye on your head because everybody has strong opinions about training, right? So I'm not going to just casually just make that decision. I am going to seek the input of the people on the team that I trust. So to your point, if we've already helped them and they don't know it's because we've got a deal going, but we've helped them out of what seems organic, that creates such an affinity for you because they're like, I already like, you're telling me he's in consideration? Yes, I've seen his stuff. I'll validate his stuff. Let's go with him. And it doesn't say that makes the decision, but it certainly doesn't hurt us.
Oh, no, not at all. Another thing when I've taught multi-threading that I bring up for reps too that don't have quite as much experience maybe doing this is that McKinsey & Company has a stat that 63% of change management efforts fail at large companies. And I think like making the point that, you know what, buying stuff is infinitely more risky than selling stuff that goes bad. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's what a buyer really cares about. It doesn't start after you sell something as a seller. Like for them, the journey begins when they start implementing, you know, and then they have a launch or whatever it might be. I want to make sure we don't run out of time for this question. So, okay, so you're talking to the stakeholder, right? You're engaging end users, that sort of stuff. How mechanically do you start to loop in other people? So are you suggesting that they invite the people on? Are you saying I can reach out to them and CC you on it? Are you kind of asking them and like for their guidance on it? And I get there's a lot of different situations where you might do all three of those things in a different situation, but how do you think about like getting other people to actually get on the conversations and to actually start engaging with them?
Some of this, I think, unfortunately, is just intuition, right? When I'm speaking to someone, I'm imagining how well are they going to, and like, even if I write it for them, how are they going to deliver this? Are they going to be waiting all around for the perfect moment? Or are they just like, there's one of those people that are fired up about the problem and they'll go. And so a little bit of his intuition, but I actually am more so in the camp of, and I know this, again, maybe not a popular opinion. In most cases, I want them to be going to the buying group. Because I am a sales rep, right? Like I am biased towards them solving this problem. When that person is motivated enough to say, I will go and I will ask, I think that actually looks good for the deal, as long as they do it really well. When someone says, yeah, these are the names, go set it up. I'm kind of like, how much are they going to really slam their fist on the table in that meeting if they don't even want to set the meeting up?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm in that camp.
not to mention the logistics are so much more difficult for a rep to set a meeting with four or five really busy people, you know? Yes. Yeah. So it's all about, I guess people are calling it buyer enablement now. So how can I arm this person if I do feel like they're a mobilizer with the right information? And again, you're even going to the extent of like writing the email for them or giving them the content that they need to really easily have this conversation in the right way with the right language, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's like, it sounds hard, and I'm not saying this to you because I know you look at the world this way too, but it's a framework email and you're just swapping out the unique way they talk about the problem. So I think the excuse of like, it's too much work or it's extra work is garbage, because it's a short email. I'm not writing a novella about this, and I'm just swapping in their native language so that it doesn't feel like some sales rep mass email that they're pushing along. So I think setting up that system becomes really scalable really fast.
Love it. Well, hey, we're about out of time. I think there's a lot that I took away from this call. There's one of them, I thought it was a really interesting kind of way to look at the time frame of consensus and what type of consensus you're trying to get. So instead of pushing really hard for consensus around the solution, when it's time to have that conversation, let's look to have early consensus around the problem so that we know that we're talking about the right thing and we know that other people care about it and they know that they feel it's somewhat of a priority. Love that part. The other thing I thought was really interesting too is like proactively looking for people that are skeptical. That's pretty cool. It's very counterintuitive because oftentimes I think in sales, we want to avoid the people that are skeptical, right? It's like, fuck, I don't want to go into a call where someone's like, yeah, AE shouldn't prospect. That's not their job. I'm like, oh, fuck, dude, really? Like, I have to have this. Come on, man. You know? Yeah, I love this. And then the other thing too is that end users play. That's something that we're in the process right now of putting together. And I'm like, oh, that kind of validated what I was thinking there, where it's like, let's build some fans, you know, at this company. Cool. This has been great. Let us know, where can people go to connect with you? You're up to something completely new now, here in the last, month. So yeah, tell us a little bit more. Where can people go to connect with you and follow you, and what are you up to these days?
Yeah, I've only ever made one TikTok video, and it will probably be the only one I ever make. So don't look for me on TikTok. I live on LinkedIn. I love having conversations like this. So it's just Jen Allen on LinkedIn. And yes, this is day two of starting at Lavender, which for those of you that don't know it, it is an email writing assistant. So instead of like, everybody's all worried that AI is going to take over our sellers' jobs, it's not writing emails for you. Think of it like a coach that is helping you correct mistakes that we tend to make, like lots of I/we language, bad tone, no personalization, no relevance, all that good stuff. So I'm heading up community and partnerships there, which is a totally new space. I've gone to the dark side. I'm in marketing. That's what I'm doing.